Well, first off, I want to welcome those of you who just arrived. I think they said there are 9 people, right, just came. So you're all here and there around the room. Welcome, everybody. We were waiting for you. We were missing you, and now everything is fine. You're here. And I know that there are a few of you, Bay Area Dharma comrades, who have never been to Sammish before, so especially you guys, we welcome to this very special place. This is a great place for practice because we have the sky and we don't have the herons anymore. I'm sorry that you missed the herons, but we have the sky and some eagles and other birds, and pretty beautiful. So we're all here, finally. This very special band of Dharma friends, mysteriously. Whether we've been here before many, many times, or a few times, or never, it feels like we've all been here before. And that we've always been here. And we always will be here. It feels like we're in a kind of a half dream, bathed in silence. No talking, none of the usual ways with words of expressing our personalities. So we are expressing our entire lives silently, without words, with our bodies, and with our hearts that our bodies express. And maybe this is a more pure expression, a more eloquent expression, a more honest expression than any kind of other expression we could make. They always say that Suzuki Roshi would remark that when he would see everyone standing and walking and bowing in the Zendo, wearing the same clothes, walking the same way, standing the same way, bowing the same way, he could see each one's uniqueness much better than when everybody was talking and wearing their preferred clothing and pretending to be themselves. So this week, instead, we're pretending to be Zen monks. And we are comporting ourselves with the formality of Zen monks. Usually, as I say, we're pretending to be somebody else. And instead of living this particular dream, we're living the ordinary dream of our name and our history and of the passing times in which we live. Who are we in actual fact, in the end? Who are we really? It may not be entirely clear. Of course, there is no phenomenon that we could refer to as silence. There's always some sound, always. Maybe it's just birdsong. Maybe it's the wind sighing in the trees. Maybe you can't hear any of that, only you can hear the heartbeat, the breath, the hum of space. So I always enjoy when I come to Sammish, especially here, practicing listening to silence. And I recommend this wonderful practice. It's so delightful. And the way you do it is first you return to your body. You bring awareness to your body. You feel your body, which, of course, isn't exactly right because when you feel your body, it isn't just your body. What we experience as our body is actually the feeling of our body and also the feeling of the earth, which is attracted to our body. It loves our body, and so it's pulling our body toward its center. So when we say we're feeling our body, we're feeling that. We're feeling our body and we're feeling the earth pulling our body toward herself, toward her deepest heart. So in order to practice listening, first we feel what we call our body, and then we breathe in a wonderful breath, which is not your breath or my breath, but life's breath. Life's desire to constantly renew itself. So in that way, we start by feeling our so-called body, our so-called breath. And when we do that, we immediately, just in doing that, open up a big space of awareness, even in one breath, two breaths. Returning to the body, stillness occurs and awareness is opened up. And we feel this profoundly during sesshin, but actually, once you established it, you can feel it anytime and anywhere. And then within that spaciousness, you listen. And now you listen not just with your ears and your brain, but with the whole of your body and breath. And you let the sound go all the way in to the heart, listening to the wind, the birds, the rustling of clothing, creaking of the floor or a chair, grass swooshing underfoot while the swallows are darting this way and that way, which makes a slight scooping sound. It's especially fun to listen to the meal. You should listen to the meal. I listen. And if you listen to the meal, it will change the way you use your spoon and your chopsticks. Who thinks I'm making a sound when I'm eating? But you are. It's a symphony of sound. And you can tell how mindful or not mindful we are if you listen to the meal. So it's very beautiful practice to listen to the sound of the silence. And what a relief it is from the entangling thoughts that make the world such a world of difficulty. Maybe we could say, as Dogen says, that to listen to silence is to let things advance and confirm the self, rather than the other way around. The other way around is how we usually live. We push the self forward into the world, and that's rough, because you have to push pretty hard, and it wears you out. To be able to receive the world as it rises and passes away is a very, very different feeling. You are the same, the world is the same, but the feeling is completely different, and so your activity is completely different. When we were at Tassajara this winter, we were practicing the six subtle Dharma gates to the sublime. And I was giving some Dharma talks about this, and if you want to hear them, they're online. I talked about this in great detail. But I want to just, in brief, bring them up again this morning. They're called the six subtle gates to the sublime because when you practice them, it leads you to the sublime, the beautiful. The sublime is a special kind of beauty. A beauty that's more than ornamental or pleasant, although it is pleasant. But it's the kind of beauty that touches you to the core, that is awesome and profound. The beauty may be of a storm or a vast sky or the limitless ocean waves. So these six subtle gates open you up to this kind of beauty. And I know that probably most of you are familiar with them already because I'm always bringing them up in different ways. I don't always call them the six subtle gates, and sometimes I only bring up one or two, but I'm sure you've heard this before. But I thought I would remind us all. So here are the six subtle Dharma gates to the sublime. The first one is counting the breath. You count the breath on the exhale from 1 to 10. I know we have a room full of very experienced Zen students here and meditators. It would be fun. Somebody can do this, like tote up the total number of years of practice experience in the room here. It might come into the thousands of years in the room, I don't know. A very experienced group of meditators who many of you have probably left counting practice far behind. But actually, the practice of counting the breath is very profound. And it can be surprising how deep it is just to count every exhale carefully from 1 to 10. And then if your mind wanders and you lose count, as it surely will, you start over again at 1. And sometimes that's just it, you know, 1, 1, 1, 1. But how many numbers do you need? You know, 1. Actually, 1 would be good, just to count 1, 1, 1, 1 would be as far as you need to go, I think. But if you can, you can get up to 3, 5, all the way up to 10. Start again at 1. So that's the first Dharma gate. The next Dharma gate is following the breath in the belly. Just watching the breath coming and going deep in the belly, rising and falling peacefully. And when the mind wanders, you just bring it back to this peaceful feeling of the belly moving in and out. And, you know, the wandering mind is our great teacher. Because whatever arises in the mind in just this minute must be there in your mind in just that moment. Because the whole of reality from the beginning of the universe has conspired to produce that thought in your mind in that moment, or that feeling, or that sensation that draws your attention. So that thought, that feeling, that sensation that arises in your mind interrupting your counting must be, for you, the most important thing in the universe at that time. But exactly because it is the most important thing, you owe it full respect. So you should bear witness to it and don't defile it with your attachment and aversion and your usual storyline. Just really bear witness to it and really appreciate it in its depth and let go. Let it go as it will go. Let it arise in its awesomeness and let it slip away and return to the sensation of following the breath in the belly in and out, in and out, in and out, and let that thought return to its essential nature. The third Dharma gate I usually call, because these Dharma gates are given in other languages, and you know, what's the best way to translate it into our language? So I call the third gate to vivify or bring to life. And this requires imagination, to use your imagination to make your breath come alive. It's not just a mechanical thing, breathing. It can be life, it can be alive. And the breath can be bright. It can be oceanic. It can be the most lively thing ever. And you can feel the breath like that. You can just feel how wonderful it is, every breath that comes and goes. And you can practice vivifying the breath while you're counting, while you're following. And when you do practice it, your mind becomes very stable. And the breath becomes very deep and very peaceful. And it's like the whole world is lighting up with every breath. I call the fourth Dharma gate discrimination, which means that you are now noticing the whole of the breath, not just where it comes in and out of the belly, but the whole of the breath from the beginning, middle, and end of the inhale to the turning of the great tide of breathing as it then becomes the exhale, beginning, middle, and end. And then that slow, long ebb of the breath until you fall off the breath slowly, slowly, slowly into this little tiny gap of nothingness where there's no breathing. As Tim, I think, mentioned in his first talk. And then life inhales you again out of nowhere, gathering energy to flow on and on. So now you feel like you're riding the breath in and out, and every breath is a whole journey, a whole lifetime of permanence, impermanence. The fifth gate is questioning. So now you're sitting on the edge of your seat, so to speak. And now you're making a big effort to discover what has never been discovered, to see what has never been seen, to fully realize the path of the Buddha. Big effort, but at the same time, very grounded, very stable. And there you are, at the edge of your seat, waiting. You're pregnant with waiting. But you're not waiting for something, you're waiting for nothing. If you're waiting for something, then you're caught, right? Then you're not even anywhere near any of the six subtle Dharma gates. You're just sort of sitting there trying to escape your predicament, which is impossible. So no, you're sitting there like you're sitting on a steep cliff at the edge of the universe, waiting, waiting, waiting for nothing. And the breath is going on and on and on, and maybe you don't even notice it. And out of this vast and deep calm, you are grounded, and you are asking, what is it? What is it? What is it? What is this being alive stuff? Who is this person anyway? What is this breath? Maybe you actually have these words, but maybe it's not words. It's just this feeling of asking, of searching, of seeking. And you're completely desperate because this question is the most urgent thing. And at the same time, you're totally peaceful and content and you don't care at all. So the sixth Dharma gate, is just leaping off. There's nothing. Nothing's happening. The world is just there, and it's sublime. It's beautiful. It's awesome. It's you. You're it. But, you know, those are all traditional things we say, and they're romantic, really, because they make it sound so great, you know. But actually, there literally is nothing to it. There's a lot of joy, but there's nothing to it. It's not a big thing. Basically, you're just sitting there. That's a lot, right? Just sitting. So now, to be sure, in his discussion, these Dharma gates in this text is by Juri, the great founder of Tiantai School of Buddhism in China, I think maybe 5th century, 6th century in there. What's a century, you know? anyway, he says in his discussion of these six gates that each of the gates contains all the others. So, in other words, all six gates can be realized on any one of the six. So this is just to say that you don't need to remember, let's see, what was the fourth gate? What was the third gate? You don't need to think like that. The point is just to devote yourself to the breath and to develop the breath and let the breath develop you. Anyway, I'm saying all this not because I'm telling you should all be practicing this, because by now, maybe you're practicing some other way that you feel good about and don't need to be disturbed by all this. But I thought for those of you who might be ready for switching, or maybe you've already been practicing like this, I would say all that. So, since yesterday, Tim brought up Shuifeng and Yanto, I thought I would also bring them up too, because for one thing, I think I should finish the story that he started yesterday but didn't finish because you know who wouldn't let him. I can't say her name because then she'll talk to us. Right, Siri?
So, time too.
So he left us, like a cliffhanger there when Shuifeng and Yanto were stranded in the mountains on pilgrimage. So we'll get to that in a minute. But it turns out that Suzuki Roshi talked about Shuifeng and Yanto on June 1st, 1964, when he was 60 years old or so, and it was a beautiful moment, I think, in his life because he had, you know, wonderful American students, but not so many of them. I think it was before the onslaught of many, many people coming. So he probably was able to really think about Dharma and be sharing Dharma with people in a quiet way. Anyway, he gave a very careful talk about these two Dharma brothers, and so the rest of my talk is going to be Suzuki Roshi's talk. In 1964, Suzuki Roshi and almost everybody in the Zen world was using the Japanese names, Japanese readings of the Chinese ancestors, because that's how they had learned them. So in his talk, Suzuki Roshi will refer to Shuifeng as Seppo and Yanto as Ganto. Seppo and Ganto, a famous pair. And their names in Japanese sound like two extra Marx brothers. Harpo, Chico, Zeppo, Seppo, and Ganto. So that has always endeared me to these two great Zen ancestors. So here now is Suzuki Roshi talking. Seppo was a good example of a well-trained Zen master. One of the old sayings, a catchword in Zen practice, is about Seppo: three times a visitor to Tosu and nine times an attendant to Tozai. In other words, he went to visit these great Zen masters three times and nine times, and each visit, you know, was a lengthy and arduous pilgrimage. So that was a way of saying this is, you know, serious practice: three times visit, nine times visit. He was born in 822 and he died in 908, near the end of the Tang Dynasty. The emperor of the Tang Dynasty was killed by Shuzhenchu in 904. The next and last emperor of the Tang Dynasty was supported by this traitor, and he lasted only for 4 years. And that was the end of the Tang Dynasty. And it was followed by a dark, restless period, a severe persecution of Buddhism occurred when Seppo was 20 years old in 845. Metalware throughout the land was turned into coin, including temple bells and images of Buddha. 4,600 temples were destroyed. 26,500 priests and nuns were cast out of the order and returned to lay life, along with 2,000 priests of all the other religions, with the exception of Taoism, that was supported by the throne. So Suzuki Roshi tells us this. Usually you don't get this kind of information, but I think Suzuki Roshi is thinking about this because this sort of thing happened a lot in Chinese Buddhism, even in our time. You know, in the 1960s, the same thing happened in Chinese Buddhism. And also in Japan, throughout history, until now, I guess recently, after the World War II, Buddhism was completely under the control of the government, and often when the government changed, terrible things could occur. And Suzuki Roshi himself, I think he mentions this thing about all the metalware being melted down, because that happened to him, including the temple bell of Rinzhou'in was melted down during World War II for the war effort to make bullets and guns. So he had lived through tough times, Suzuki Roshi. During the war in Japan, there was hardly any food. People would come to his temple for rice. So he was quite aware that hard times were always just a step away. So he mentions all this. He goes on. The other principal character of this case, because he's going to talk about, this is his introduction to case 51 of the Blue Cliff Record. So the other character in this case is Ganto, who lived from 828 to 887, and they were good friends, Seppo and Ganto. Both were born in the province of Fujian. Both went on long, hard pilgrimages from northeast to southeast China, visiting many famous Zen masters, as we said a moment ago. They practiced really hard. And later, they received a transmission from Tokusan Senkan. And after that, Seppo was 44 years old and Ganto was 38 years old, and they left Tokusan and they started out on pilgrimage again to visit other Zen masters and continue their practice. So now we come to Tim's unfinished story, in Suzuki Roshi's words. And this story happened when Seppo and Ganto had left Deshan, or Tokusan, to go on pilgrimage. So he says, at Gosanchin, they were caught in a heavy snowstorm. Seppo was sitting all the while that Ganto was sleeping. And Ganto said to him, "This village is like a fortified town. Why don't you sleep?" So that's kind of interesting, you know, because here it seems like Suzuki Roshi's thinking about all the hard times in China, which reminded him of all his own hard times. And this line here that I just read makes it sound like Seppo wasn't just sitting in Zazen to get awakened. He was sitting in Zazen because he couldn't sleep. He was a little nervous that an army might come and invade the monastery, as actually did sometimes happen, as we will hear in a few minutes. So that's the spirit in which he was sitting. But when you come to think of it, maybe even though we're not perhaps worried about an invading army, maybe we are. You know, maybe you are sitting sometimes with great desperation, nervous about our lives and our fates and our collective fates, what might happen to us all, sitting looking for some kind of protection or miracle or something. At any rate, Seppo was sitting all night with a sense of urgency, and Ganto was sleeping, but then Ganto woke up and said, why are you so obsessed with this? Why are you so urgent about this? And Seppo rubbed his heart like this, and he said, I just don't have ease of heart. I just don't have ease of heart. So Ganto said, well, and this is Suzuki Roshi is translating here from, you know, the Japanese Blue Cliff Record text. He translates Ganto saying, please tell me one by one what you have acquired. So in other words, he's saying to Seppo, okay, you don't have ease at heart, and yet, you know, you've practiced a lot, so tell me what you've learned. And let me see if I can figure out, like, why aren't you feeling better here, you know? Tell me. So Seppo, you know, told him all the things, all the experiences that he had had in practice, how he was with Tozan and he learned this, and then he was with Tokusan, as they had both been, and he learned this and that. And this is when Ganto, this is the part Tim didn't get to, that is really the punchline of the story, and to me, the most beautiful, one of the most beautiful of all Zen stories, when Ganto says to Seppo, all those insights, all those treasures that you have received, every one of them comes from the outside. And so they are not your family treasure. The family treasure comes from the inside, not outside. And at this, Seppo was awakened. He was 44 years old. So I've always loved this story. And it's so true. You know, what you get from the tradition, what you get from others, from your teachers, even from your own insights that are external insights. Oh, I understood that, and I understood that, and I understood that. These are all external things, and they will not save you. They will not ease the pain in your heart. Because the family treasure does not come from outside. It is and has been inside. And when you find it, you have the sense that it was there all along. You didn't need to get anything at all. Ha ha, what a stupid joke. You spent all this time looking for this thing. That it was right there the whole time. It was already there in the very conditioned heart you were trying so desperately to escape. That's what Ganto is telling Seppo, and he hears it. He really listens to it, and he hears it. So the next year, they picked up another companion, Kinzan Bunsui, who was a disciple of Tozan, Dongshan in Chinese. And they all three decided they would go to Rinzai's temple to study. So they took the long journey. Who knows how many weeks you traveled, you know, to go from one temple to another. But on the way, they met somebody who said, "Oh, too bad for you, Rinzai just died." So they changed their plans. And Ganto went to Ryozan near Lake Dotai. And Kinzan went back to his temple, and Seppo returned to the south. And these are all things Suzuki Roshi is telling us, the stuff that we wouldn't even bother to think about because China's so far away, you know. But to Suzuki Roshi, China's not so far away. And those days of ancient China are not so far away for him. So he goes on. When Seppo was 47, he secluded himself at a stone cave, which had been the first residence of his old master, Reikun. By the way, Suzuki Roshi also has access in Japanese to many commentaries that have never been translated. So those of us who don't read Japanese medieval commentaries, which is most of us, don't know these things that he's telling us. So when he was 54, he had his own temple beautifully built on the top of a mountain. And when he was 60, the age that Suzuki Roshi is now, he had 1,050 students. And Suzuki Roshi's probably thinking, "Well, I have 47 students. And I'm also 60. And I'm living in San Francisco, not the top of the mountain, but what the hell." Anyway, one of his students, Suzuki Roshi says, was Ummon, who was went out to become a famous Zen master and the founder of the Ummon school. So maybe Suzuki Roshi was thinking, "I wonder which one of my sloppy American disciples is going to be Ummon." And a purple robe was presented to him by Emperor Kiso, and his posthumous name is Shinkaku Daishi, great master Shinkaku. So anyway, this is all background that Suzuki Roshi is giving us to Seppo and Ganto, and now he's ready to bring up case 51 of Blue Cliff Record. But first, he has to give us all the introductory word by Engo. So Engo's introductory word says, "If you are caught by the slightest idea of good and bad, your mind," and Suzuki Roshi aside says, meaning your true mind, your true essence of mind, "your mind will be lost in the realm of disorder. If you are caught by the slightest idea of good and bad, your mind will be lost in the realm of disorder. If you do not have an idea," and this is sort of on the other hand, on the one hand, if you are caught by the slightest idea of good or bad, in other words, discrimination, your true mind will be lost in the realm of disorder. On the other hand, if you don't have an idea of the order of stages, discriminating the order of stages, then your practice will be without purpose. So which do you think is better, to pursue the relative way or to resume to the absolute? That's Engo's introduction, and Suzuki Roshi now comments here about that. He says, "The relative form and color that you see now are the conditioned attributes of the unconditioned, the constant, the absolute. The absolute is the eternal unconditionality that gives rise to the conditioned relative ways of practice. What you see now is the eternal unconditionality of the absolute and the momentous conditioned relative." So I pause for a moment so you can digest this. He seems to be telling us that literally what you see right now in a moment of sense perception, which in this case with your eyes, you are seeing the eternal, unconditional of the Absolute. And at the same time, in the same act of perception, the conditioned reality of just this moment. So he goes on. Actually, the positive or relative way is not different from the negative or absolute way. Even though you follow the order of the stages in your actual practice, if each relative stage, even the first stage, even the very beginning of your practice, is brought out in full relief against the darkness of the Absolute, and if there's no fumbling and groping in your practice under the right teacher, then your practice is already in the realm of reality with a capital R. Each relative stage bears the full meaning of the Absolute. So we're reaching for the Absolute, but it's in every stage. So even though you're in this stage, like, you know, beginning stage, it's the beginning stage. But the end is already there in the beginning stage. If you think you're going toward, it's here already. Each relative stage bears the full meaning of the Absolute, and the Absolute reveals its actual meaning in the relative practice. And if you want to understand this secret, Suzuki Roshi says, you must study under the right teacher, not only by words, but also by actual conduct on each moment under particular circumstances. To continue with Engo's introduction, because Suzuki Roshi didn't finish the introduction, Engo's words in his translation. If you become attached to some particular way of expressing Zen, captivated by something told in words or verse, attached to some method of instruction, like scolding voice, slapping face, seizing by the collar and casting off, drawing a circle, lifting up one finger, and so on, all actual methods that were used. If you get attached to some method of instruction, or some words or verses, then you're just like a parasitic weed wrapped around a dead tree. And I'm going to here skip the sacred, holy Suzuki Roshi's words a few, so not to make this too long. And I'll comment on Suzuki Roshi's comment just to say that, just to notice that what he's saying is really important and surprising. He's saying that whatever form practice may take, the actual practice is not that form. So you accept the form and you practice the form, but if you think the practice is the form, and here form doesn't just mean like, you know, the way you bow or something, it also means like words, doctrines, insights, ideas. If you think that those things are the true practice and the true reality, then you're stuck. Again, you're stuck. Now you're just stuck on a higher class thing called Zen, you know, but you're stuck. So that was, anyway, all that was his commentary to the introduction. Now he gets to the main case, and here's the main story. So when Seppo was in his hermitage on Mount Seppo, which is why he's called Seppo, because that was where he lived, two monks visited him and they bowed. And when Seppo saw them coming, he opened up his gate and he jumped out and he said, "What is it?" And they were, you know, totally startled. And they said right away, "What is it?" And so Seppo bowed and they bowed and he went away. He went back inside. That was it. So then, these same two monks went to visit Ganto. And Ganto said, where did you come from? And they said, well, we came from Renan. And Ganto said, oh, if you went to Renan, then you must have met my old Dharma brother, Seppo. And they said, yes, we did meet Seppo. And they said, well, what did Seppo say? And they told him the whole story, you know, that I just told you. And Ganto said, well, so what did all that amount to? And the monk said, well, nothing. He didn't really say anything. He just bowed and went away. And Ganto said, oh, how terrible. What have I done? What have I done? When I was with Tokusan, I should have told him, when we were there together, I should have told him the last word. If only I had told him the last word, he would not be as confused as he seems to be now. That's what Ganto said. And so you recall the story that Tim told us yesterday, right? This refers to the story we heard yesterday. Without going into the whole story, you remember Ganto says, oh, the teacher doesn't have the last word, and he goes in and whispers to the teacher, remember? And then the teacher goes and gives a brilliant Dharma talk, and Ganto's very happy. He straightened him out, I guess. He gave him the last word, but he didn't give the last word to Seppo, see? Oh, no, I should have given Seppo the last word, too. So we have this question of the last word, right? What is the last word? Now, most translators translate as the last word, which we would take to mean, you know, the ultimate word, the final word, the big secret of Zen, or whatever, the last word. But I actually, when I read that, I did not actually read the word Suzuki Roshi translated, because Suzuki Roshi does not translate that phrase as the last word. He translates it, apparently, quite literally, as the word of my dying bed. Literally, my last word, right? My deathbed word, which is the last word. So that's the last word, right? The sort of final, ultimate understanding of a lifetime. An understanding that we could maybe say goes all the way out to the end and falls off. In other words, it's the understanding of death beyond this life. And to me, this is very beautiful and very, very salient, because I always feel like we don't know. You know, there are no Zen masters, you know, because to me, like, who's going to know what this is about, really? If this is about something important, who's going to know what that is? And who can know? Because all we are is human. We just have these little eyes and ears and this little brain that works by language, and language is so clumsy, how could we ever understand anything? We are so limited by our human life. But we will, in the end, slough off our limitation. And then maybe we can really understand, or anyway, we can leap into the arms of that which we cannot understand. Maybe this is the last word. Maybe that's what the last word is about. Anyway, so Suzuki Roshi says, too bad I didn't give Seppo the word of my dying bed. But that's not the end of the story. These two monks who just arrived at Ganto's place asked if they could stay the summer when they had the practice period, and they stayed the summer. And at the end of the summer practice period, the two monks came again to Ganto, and they asked him, now, would he please explain further the meaning of Seppo's weird behavior when they met him? And what did Ganto mean, they asked, when he said, "How I wish I had told him my last word." And so Ganto said, "Well, why didn't you ask me this before?" And they said, "Well, we thought it would be presumptuous of us to ask for such a valuable thing, precious thing, as your last word." So it's a kind of interesting point, you know. They went all this way, right, to meet Ganto and ask Ganto about this matter. But they didn't feel that it was right, proper, to ask him that question at that time. They needed to be there for 90 days practicing with him until they knew him well enough, knew his Dharma well enough to ask him the question. Or maybe they felt like if they asked him the question prematurely, even if he gave them the answer, they wouldn't be able to hear it. They needed to practice with him for 90 days before they could hear his answer. Which goes to show you that questions are not just questions and answers are not just answers. It is a matter of timing. It's a matter of the conditions being right. Sometimes you already know the answer, but that doesn't matter. Because even if you know it, you aren't ready to truly understand it. And we're focusing all the time our attention on the answer, right? What's the answer? But there's no big answer. How many Zen stories have you heard where one person gives the answer, totally wrong, completely wrong, get out of here. So the next person comes, gives the same answer, perfect answer. How many times have you heard that Zen story? There's a million of them like that, because it's not the answer. Answers are outside. The treasure is inside. It's the time, the timing, the conditions. And answers create occasions. That's the point of questions and answers. Anyway, the story goes on. And Ganto is now going to give these monks the answer. And you're going to hear the answer to the last word. So here it is. So Ganto says to the monks at this point after the 90-day practice period, "Seppo is a fellow countryman of mine. We're very close. We always went on pilgrimage together. And even though we're very close and always live together, we will not die together. And if you want to know my last word for Seppo and you, I will tell you my last word. This is it." So that's it. That's the answer. This is the word of Seppo's dying bed. This is it. This is not just any old this, right? It is this sublime, awesome, beyond everything we could ever understand or know, this. And it's just you and me eating lunch. Tsuki Roshi comments, "Wherever Seppo and Ganto might be, however long they might live as best friend of one another, what Seppo did is actual Seppo, and what Ganto did is actual Ganto. This is it, should always be the last word for oneself and for others." So he's telling us that you're always going to be you, and I'm always going to be me. And we can't imitate one another or expect to be like one another. We can practice side by side a whole lifetime, and each one of us will always be who we are. And each one will be unique and sublime expression of the Absolute. Maybe death is the truth we will finally express, and the truth we have been expressing all along through all the moments of our lives as we have been dying again and again and again to each passing moment. So death is nothing special or unique. And now Suzuki Roshi quotes Dogen Zenji, who said, "Breathing in or breathing out, after all, what is it?" And he says, Suzuki Roshi says, "No one can tell what it is." And he goes on, he says, "Now, you may not be calm or patient enough to wait for the right answer. But ask yourself, is your activity objective or subjective? And let me point this out to you. When we say, what is it? Or what is the breath? What do we mean by it? Do we mean breathing itself? Or do we mean the idea of breathing? If you mean the idea of breathing, that's another matter. If you mean breathing itself each moment, then you have solved the problem already when you breathe in and out on each moment in calmness with big mind. And now you can understand that the right answer to what is it should always be, this is it. And then Suzuki Roshi tells us that soon after, Ganto gave this last word to these two monks to bring home to Seppo, he died. He was killed, actually, because his monastery was raided in these troubled times when there were marauding monks, sometimes monks, actually, and sometimes bandits. So his monastery was raided, and I don't know how true it is, but the story was that all the monastics fled when they saw the army coming, but Ganto wouldn't leave. He sat in Zazen and would not leave the monastery, and when they came in and saw him there, they stabbed him to death, and he let out a great shout as he passed away. So when he said, this is my last word, he was not kidding. He somehow realized that his life was soon going to end, and he really was bequeathing to his dear Dharma brother Seppo, through these two monks, his most precious possession, his last word. This is it. And Suzuki Roshi says, so I'm offering my Dharma words here and my translation of this case in great homage to these two great Zen masters. And finally, I'll end with the poem on the case as translated by Suzuki Roshi. Referring to Ganto's last words to Seppo, I will ask you, enlightened mind, is daytime different from nighttime? Even though they lived fully acquainted with each other, in intimate companionship, they died in different places. Yes. They should die in different ways. Buddha should have curled hair, and Bodhidharma should be blue-eyed. From east, west, south, and north, let us all come back to our old home. And here, in the midnight sky, see a plain white mountain covered with snow. I'm just a Shogaku Shunryo Daiyosho, right? What a great Dharma talk you gave us. Thank you very much. May our intention equally extend to every being and place.